Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for attending this late today. I know I'm the only thing between you and dodgeball and maybe serious injury, so appreciate having you here. This is Building Hybrid Applications Using Windows Azure. My name's Chris Padgett. I'm a development consultant with Collider Solutions in Melbourne. Over the next hour or so, I'll be covering a few topics. Firstly, I'll introduce hybrid applications, benefits of them, the challenges associated with them. I'll then introduce four Windows Azure platform technologies, namely SQL Data Sync, Service Bus, Connect, and Access Control Service. Introduce what they are, what they can do for us when we are building hybrid applications on Windows Azure. And I'll interrupt slides with demonstrations now and again. How many people attended either Richard's session yesterday or Rocky's session this morning? Yep. Thankfully, both of those guys provided a backstory to building hybrid applications or why we should be building hybrid applications, and which kind of makes my session a little easier. This is a level 200 on the notice board. It's probably a little more level 300 than I expected, so there'll be a bit of code. So I hope to keep you awake between now and the end of the session. Okay. What I want to demonstrate throughout this session is an adaptation of an open source ASP.NET MVC web application called MVC Music Store. If you're new to ASP.NET MVC development, this is a good getting started application. And what I've done is I've adapted it to be running in Windows Azure as a web role. And I've also adapted it such that I can synchronize data between it and an on-premise database, which is represented on running on my local computer. And also, as part of the service bus and access control service demonstrations, we'll be looking at the capability of integrating this web role running in Windows Azure with, again, services running on my local computer, but also identity providers provided by Google, Yahoo, Microsoft, and so on. So hybrid applications. So let me put a definition to you. What is a hybrid application? Well, there's a range of definitions of hybrid applications. This is probably the best one, or the one I'm most fond of. A hybrid application uses a range of components, resources, and services that are separated across either geographical boundaries, which may be data centers, be they public cloud data centers or your local data center, maybe a service provider that you're using. Separated across network boundaries, being the internet and maybe your intranet, and also trust boundaries, security boundaries. Hybrid applications are traditionally thought of as, you know, parts or components that are running in a public cloud, such as Windows Azure, and those that run on premises, but maybe actually components that run in one public cloud and other components or resources or services that are run in another public cloud. What I'll focus on today are the Windows Azure platform technologies that support the public cloud on-premises scenario. This is an example of a hybrid application, which I've lifted from a patents and practices guide, which I'll provide a link to you at the end of this session. This is a complex hybrid application. There are a number of components, resources, and services that are incorporated into this architecture. Basically, there are devices, desktops, tablets, mobiles, and so on, that are having their traffic routed across a number of Windows Azure data centers. They may be the ones located in the US, Asia or Europe. Each of those data centers are effectively hosting the same application components, resources and services. You can see there are SQL Azure databases or Windows Azure SQL databases. There's an orders application, which might be a web role. There is a VM that's being hosted up there that's a compliance application. There's other business logic. There's authentication being federated with social identity providers such as LiveID, Google, Yahoo and so on. And on top of all that, there are partners involved, and there's the head office involved. This being the on-premises environment, I guess, we're concerned with today. So on-premises, we have reporting services running. We have monitoring and management applications that maybe a DevOps or infrastructure team might be running. We have custom applications such as an audit log listener, which may be pulling data or synchronizing data from the public cloud to the on-premises environment to do all that compliance or audit logging, whatever may be required. So the benefits of hybrid applications. You've probably heard this a million times over the last 3 days if you've attended some of the Windows Azure sessions. Yes, there are cost savings associated with in the cloud compute, storage, and network. But above and beyond that, Why would you consider a hybrid application or cloud applications in general? You may choose to federate your identity, where you may have a large user base that you don't necessarily want to manage the identity of. So there are options for federating identity of those users. We'll cover that a bit later when I discuss ACS. You have insurance against data loss. This is where whether you're using Windows Azure storage or SQL Azure storage, that storage is replicated three times and can be replicated across data centers. So there's some insurance implicit in that design. And of course, the public cloud brings us availability and scalability is kind of beyond, well, generally speaking, what we can provide with an on-premise environment. So there are all the benefits. So why not just build a public cloud application? Why build or even have to consider a hybrid application? If you did attend Rocky's session this morning, we covered a lot of this in detail. There are a number of reasons why you may have to consider building a hybrid application. Maybe because your on-premises applications and services that you would love to migrate to the cloud just might be end of life and cannot be migrated. They may be on a proprietary platform. It may be legacy code that you don't own. There may be a number of reasons why you can't migrate to the cloud. Or those on-premises applications and services may be sharing data that you don't want to take to the public cloud. Okay, so a number of reasons why you may not be able to just forklift applications from the on-premises environment into the public cloud environment. As far as data is concerned, and maybe I should soften this language given what we learnt in Rocky's session this morning, you may have proprietary data or regulated data or sensitive data that might be required, in inverted quotes, to be stored on premises or at least kept onshore. Required in inverted quotes, meaning that, as Rocky mentioned this morning, a lot of the perception of data sovereignty and so on, isn't perhaps as common as you may think. So there are no strict laws around what data you can host, you have to host on premises or at least onshore. Maybe I'll just soften that required bit a little bit. But in general, they're the most common reasons why we have to consider building hybrid applications and not just cloud applications. Okay, so we're considering building one of these hybrid applications. There are a number of challenges that I've found associated with building these types of apps. The ones I want to highlight to you, probably the most one that should be listed first, is cross-boundary communication. So as I demonstrated a bit later, we can relay service calls from application or web front-end components that might be running in the public cloud, relay them to back-end services that are running on-premises. Because those data centres are around the world and not in Australia, and most of our premises are in Australia, there is latency, is a big factor in the performance of that cross-boundary communication. What that generally means is you may have to, if you're not building a new application, as a hybrid application, you may be re-engineering an existing one. Just consider the chunkiness or the chattiness of those calls across that communication boundary. Similarly, data that may be currently hosted on premises, you may want to push or synchronise to the public cloud, to Windows Azure. Obviously, the closer the data is to those application components, the better the performance. So we have to consider that. That's a bit of a challenge. I've mentioned here availability, performance and scalability, which was kind of one of the benefits of building a hybrid application. One of the challenges associated with building hybrid applications is, yes, Windows Azure offers infinite scale and infinite availability. If you're hosting services on premises, you effectively have to scale with it to some degree. Okay, so as you may be scaling your web rollout to support a growing number of users, any on-premises services or resources that are supporting that cloud application generally have to be as available or be as scalable as the cloud components. As far as operations infrastructure are concerned, your operations team may be new to Windows Azure, the deployment and the packaging and everything else that's required, so that's a consideration. And in general, without trying to instill fear in you, it is difficult to build hybrid applications, a lot of considerations. So where does Windows Azure fit into this? What is Windows Azure in general? This is how does it apply in the context of building hybrid applications? Well, as you might have learned over the last couple of days, is that Windows Azure provides a range of services to us as developers. not just about compute, storage and networking, a range of other things. And some of these services, quite a few of these services, enabled us to extend, migrate or offload around on-premises applications, services of data into the cloud. Microsoft call these building blocks or fabric technologies. These are the ones I'll be introducing to you this afternoon. They're the ones that help us build hybrid applications, deploy them and manage them while they're running. Effectively, it's the super glue between your software, your applications, and the services required to operate those applications. This is maybe about 3 weeks old, so there's probably something else that should be added to here, like mobile services. But this is effectively the feature map of Windows Azure. The ones we'll be focusing on today are those four. So SQL Data Sync for synchronizing data, Access Control for federating identity, Service Bus for providing cross-boundary communication, and Connect, which generally provides cross-boundary communication, but in a slightly different flavor. So I'll start with SQL Data Sync. What is it? Well, it's a cloud service that's built on the Sync framework that can be used for synchronizing data between multiple databases in multiple directions across multiple geographies. It implements a hub-spoke technology, so effectively there's a hub database that all synchronizations pass through. When I talk about multiple directions, data can be synchronized to the hub, from the hub, or to and from the hub, depending on your synchronization requirements and where you want your data to be synchronized to and from. I'll depict this in a moment with a diagram. In terms of the databases that are supported, you can synchronize data between multiple SQL Azure databases or between SQL Azure and SQL Server databases that you may be hosting on-premises or with your service provider. The only condition is that if you want to synchronize data to or from a SQL Server database, it must be 2005 SP2 or above. In terms of spanning multiple geographies, you can synchronize data across the same data center, which may be yours and may be Microsoft's, and may be your third-party service providers, or across multiple data centers. So as shown in this diagram, what this is representing is a master database that you own on-premises and you kind of feel is the master record of all data that you want to synchronize across all these data stores. There are what are known as member databases in two data centers in Windows Azure. They might be in the US, Asia or Europe, it doesn't matter. And in the middle is SQL Data Sync, this sync framework based cloud service that's running also in a Windows Azure data center, which I kind of haven't shown there, but that runs in a data center as well. Associated with that SQL Data Sync cloud service is the hub database. The hub database is a SQL Azure database as well. It can't be an on-premises one. In order to create, manage, and schedule synchronizations, you log in as administrator into the Windows Azure Management Portal and manage synchronizations from there. When you want to create a synchronization, effectively what you create is a synchronization group, which is that blue box, corner box in the middle panel there. And what it does is basically define the hub database that you want to sync to, from, or to from, and one or more SQL Azure or SQL Server member databases, wherever they may be hosted, either in the Microsoft data centers or your own data center. As well as defining the hubs and the spokes, so to speak, the hubs and the members, you also define the data set that you want to synchronize. Databases, tables, and columns. It doesn't have to be the full data set of a given database. It can be a subset of the schema. By the way, those schemas have to be the same. They can't be different, so you don't have that flexibility like you might have with sync framework. You can also define the rows that you want to be synchronized. So this might be useful when maybe in the one of the US data centers you want to only synchronize US customer data, and in one of the European data centers you may only want to synchronize European customer data that you manage in whole in your on-premise database. Okay, so you can provide row filtering in terms of the data that you want to be synchronized. Access to an on-premise SQL Server database is enabled by a client agent. So this is quite a common sort of strategy for reaching into an on-premise environment with Windows Azure. You have to install a client agent on, doesn't have to be the SQL Server database itself, but it has to be an internet-connected computer. Because what happens when you install the client agent, and I'll demonstrate this a little later, is it connects out to SQL Data Sync. There's no connection into your network. It's a connection, an outbound connection from this client agent running on one of your on-premises computers that connects out to SQL Data Sync. Here's a short list, well, not a short list, but a list of the supported data types that are supported by SQL Data Sync. It's not the complete list of data types that are supported by SQL Azure or SQL Database. For example, you won't see here user-defined types. So if you do want to synchronize data between SQL Azure and SQL Server databases that use user-defined types, you may have to remediate your schema a little bit. But for the most part, it covers the common data types. In terms of security, all accesses that are managed by SQL Data Sync, the cloud service that's running in a Windows Azure data center, are authenticated. I mentioned if you want to sync to or from an on-premises SQL Server database, you have to install a client agent. When you install and set up the client agent, you basically specify a connection string that obviously allows it to connect to your on-premises SQL Server database. That connection can either be use Windows authentication or SQL Server authentication, depending on your security requirements. SQL Data Sync then authenticates the client agent when the client agent attempts to connect to it using a shared secret. That shared secret is available to you as an administrator in the Windows Azure Management Portal. It's something you register with a client agent when you install it or at least configure it. The components within SQL Data Sync itself authenticate themselves using certificates. All the connections in and out of SQL Data Sync to all these SQL Azure and SQL Server databases are encrypted. And as part of the client agent, you can also specify that you want to encrypt the communication between the client agent itself and your on-premises SQL Server database. So that effectively it supports end-to-end encryption. And there is some data that's managed, metadata, for example, that's managed by SQL Data Sync itself. That metadata is also encrypted. So it's quite a good story in terms of how the data is secured and the communications are secured from end-to-end. One last thing before I dip into a demonstration. One of the common scenarios around data synchronization, that it doesn't really matter whether you're using SQL Data Sync or you've used Sync framework in the past, are data conflicts. Quite a common scenario. And these occur when the same data in two or more databases in the same synchronization group is changed between synchronizations. So where you may not be filtering US customers for the US data centers and European customers for the European data centers, they're all just a copy of all customers. The same customer record A in Europe may be changed at about the same time that customer record A in the US data center is also changed. Okay, so when that data is synchronized the next time, there'll be a data conflict, and that has to be resolved. SQL Data Sync offers two conflict resolution types. They're reasonably well named, hub wins or client wins, but basically what it means is either the first change row will win and all other change rows will lose. So either Europe will win or US will win, or the last change row written into the hub will win and all the other change rows will lose. Okay, so you have a couple of options there. Okay, let me show you a demo of this in action. And we might see a purple haze for a moment as this adjusts to my screen resolution. It's like looking through rose-colored glasses, I suppose. So where I want to start is with the Windows Azure Management Portal. I have a database in the cloud. I'll just refresh this. He said. I have a database in the cloud, believe me. I'll demonstrate that because when I run my demonstration MVC application, it shows some static content but no dynamic content. What we should be seeing, you might remember my previous slide, is a list of genres down the side and a list of top-selling albums across the bottom. So without that data being available in the cloud in a SQL Azure database, it has nothing to sell. What I can show you is on-premises on my local computer is MBC Music Store database. If I has a list of tables, I select the top 100 albums, and you can see them listed there at the bottom. So what I want to do is create a new synchronization group that's going to synchronize my on-premises data in the SQL Server database running on my local computer with a SQL Azure database of the same schema running in the cloud. And when I refresh my web application, we should see that data become available. Before I do that, what I've done is I've downloaded and installed the Microsoft SQL DataSync agent. By the way, this is a preview technology. It's been in preview for quite a few months now. By installing this agent, it installs two things, both a Windows service that runs all the time and like a console, if you like, that allows me to register databases I want to sync and unregister once I've finished syncing them. So I've gone ahead and installed this. I mentioned earlier there's a shared secret that has to be configured with the DataSync agent. I've copied that from my Windows Azure Management portal and registered with this DataSync client by submitting it here. I've also registered my on-premises database, MVC Music Store. In order to register other databases, you provide a server, database, and either SQL authentication, SQL Server authentication or Windows authentication credentials. So it's pretty simple. So I've gone ahead and done that already, just to save a few minutes. To begin the synchronization, what I have to do first, and what I've already done, because again it takes a few minutes, is provision a DataSync server, which is this, the first button on the left is where you start. So I've provisioned a new DataSync server. When I do that, I choose a region where I want to host that DataSync server. The only condition here is you can only host one DataSync server per subscription. So you've got to be careful about where you choose to host or provision that DataSync server to. So I've gone ahead and done that with one of my subscriptions, created a new DataSync server that is running in Southeast Asia. The next thing I have to do is create a sync group. So this, again, defines what I want to sync from and to in terms of SQL Azure database and SQL Server databases and the data set that I want to sync, the schema that I want to sync. So go ahead and create that. I give it a name. And here's where I define my sync topology, if you like. So I define the hub database, which is this band in the middle, any SQL Azure member databases that may be in other data centers around the world that I want to sync to and from, and any on-premise SQL Server databases I may want to sync to and from. So I'll start with the hub database. That's the one I couldn't list in the management portal before. I can't remember the name of my SQL Azure server, so I'll just steal it from there. MVC Music Store. And similarly, I can't remember the password. So this is similar to what I do with the SQL DataSync agent that's running on-premises. So I have to do a similar thing to register the hub database as part of the cloud service. That test okay? No. Let me go ahead and try and add it. Let me make sure it exists. Just bear with me for a minute. I just might have to log out and log back in. So let me just check the database exists. Okay, it's a bit better. So this is the one I've created. It doesn't. I've created with a sort of a basic schema, no data, which is why it's not serving data to my web application. So hopefully now, when I attempt to create the sync group again, Southeast Asia sync group. MVC Music Store, configure the Hub database. There it is. Okay, got a spinning wheel cursor this time. Connection successful, which is good. Has now registered as my Hub database as a partially green status. Next thing I want to do is go ahead and register my on-premises SQL Server database. I have a few options here. I want to add a new SQL Server database to the Sync group. So SQL Server databases you're hosting on-premises can be configured as part of multiple Sync groups. I'm configuring it for the first time. And I want to sync from my on-premises database to the Hub only. So it's kind of like a one-way sync. Next. Here you either have the option to install the client agent for the first time, or if that's already done, which is I have already done, I do it through an existing agent. Once that's done, I get a list of databases that are available on my on-premise in my on-premises environment. That's my MVC Music Store on-premises database. Finish that. And that's now registered. So you do that for the Hub and each of the member databases you want to sync. Then define, I won't enable this every 30 minutes, but you have the options of defining this synchronization frequency, which can be minutes, hours, days, or months. I was turning that off because I was doing on-demand sync in a few moments. You have to specify a conflict resolution type, Hub wins or client wins. So I'm going to say the client wins, and then you edit the data set or the database's tables and columns and rows that you want to sync. I'm going to select all the rows, except for maybe the cart, and I'll OK that. Once that's done, I've completed the configuration. The next step is going to deploy that configuration, both to the Hub database and the on-premises database, which I'll start now. And what that is doing is, in each of those databases, is creating some what are known as tracking tables. So as each synchronization is run, it's an incremental synchronization. It doesn't synchronize all data for during every synchronization, it just synchronizes the deltas. In order to do that on premises, if I just update my list of tables, you can see off to the left here, there are some additional tables, tracking tables that is added to my on-premises database, as well as the Hub database and any other member databases I might have configured as part of this sync group. Okay, so they're now ready to sync. Next step is to either to sync now manually or in the next 30 minutes or whatever my sync schedule may have been, the synchronization will start. Now this is quite a small database, it's about 300 albums with 200 artists or whatever it is, so it's not a large synchronization. So any moment now it should change from synchronizing status to synchronized. Say that again.
What's the charging model for this?
Yeah, what's the charging model? So at the moment this is preview, so you're not necessarily paying for synchronization traffic or anything like that. You're just paying for your Hub database, which is a SQL database, and any egress network.
So it's the
same as anything. Yep, that's right. So that's now switched from synchronizing to good, which means it's done. If I now go to my cloud app, hopefully I'll get it. List of genres and some albums, top-selling albums that I can now buy. So that's just a very quick example of how you can synchronize data. As you might appreciate, as part of that topology definition, you can have a much more complex synchronization. Okay. Next, service bus. So we're going kind of, I guess, going up a level in this application stack, if you like. We're synchronizing data now. We're happy that our data's our on-premise data is being synchronized to the cloud and maybe back. The service bus is another cloud service, part of the Windows Azure platform, obviously, for highly available, large-scale and secure communication. What this means is it really provides two messaging scenarios. One called relayed, which is where both client and service are connected at the same time, otherwise known as a connected scenario. And you might be familiar with some of these messaging patterns that supports relay messaging, supports one-way request response and peer-to-peer messaging. And the other messaging scenario is what's known as brokered. So this may be where client and service are not connected at the same time, otherwise known as a temporal scenario. And this is often used for asynchronous, durable, and publish-subscribe type messaging patterns. The service bus not only allows us to connect maybe a web role that's running in Windows Azure with a service that's running on-premises, either in a connected or disconnected scenario, but allows rich desktop applications that may be running in your partner organisation's web-enabled device apps running on perhaps your phone or your tablet to also connect with those on-premise services. If those on-premise services or those client applications are .NET-based ones, Service Bus has a tight integration with Windows Communication Foundation. That's what I'll demonstrate in a minute. As far as securing the services that you're publishing on the Service Bus, Service Bus integrates with Access Control Service to secure those endpoints. And again, like with SQL Data Sync, your on-premise service connects out to the Service Bus to register itself, if you like, and make itself available, rather than the Service Bus reaching into your on-premises environment. Service Bus also provides a registry, which is an Atom 1.0 feed, so that client applications can discover at design time or runtime your service endpoints and how to connect with them and integrate with them. And there's a very specialised, I guess, feature of Service Bus that allows you to tunnel non-HTTP, non-TCP traffic over it. A good example of this may be where you may want to tunnel even TDS for SQL Server integration, POP traffic, map traffic, whatever it may be. You can tunnel this over Service Bus with quite a lot of code. This is an example of what's known as, or this is not an example, this is a depiction of the Service Bus relay. So this is the relay scenario, the connected scenario, where in this example we have a cloud application that incorporates both a web role and a worker role, as well as maybe a partner application which is running a rich desktop client. They both want to connect to your WCF service that is running on-premises. In order to do that, we use the Service Bus relay to relay requests through from the clients to the service and responses back. Okay? Remembering that that WCF service is going out through the firewall rather than the Service Bus coming in through the firewall in order to make that connection. In terms of Service Bus relay support for different protocols and messaging patterns and connections and so on, they're probably very familiar with you. REST, SOAP, WS, ASTA, one-way, request response, peer-to-peer messaging patterns. And there are also different types of connections that are supported by it. The most common one is this relayed one. So this is where client is connected to the Service Bus. Service is connected to the Service Bus at the same time and all messaging is relayed through that Service Bus relay. There are alternatives to that or other options. Hybrid scenario are quite similar. What this allows is where the client and the service are connected, the Service Bus will negotiate a direct connection between those two endpoints, between the client and the service. So that means that messaging isn't relayed through the relay anymore, it's via a direct connection that's negotiated by Service Bus on behalf of the client and the service. In terms of the life cycle of services and clients as they move in and out of the Service Bus relay, services are configured using WCF relay bindings if your services are .NET based. Here's a short list of the relay bindings that are supported when you install Service Bus into your application. There are others. They basically correspond to the standard WCF bindings that you might be using today for HTTP and NetTCP. The reason we have these relay bindings is there's, logic built into them to provide this connectivity into the Service Bus at runtime. Services can connect you to the relay service using an outbound port. Well, they have to. There's not much of an option. They're the ports that they connect outbound on. And when a service connects to the relay bus, having authenticated itself with a relay service, which I'll describe in a minute, what the relay services does is create a bi-directional connection back to the service via what's known as a rendezvous URI. What that means is when a client connects to the Service Bus and wants to send a message to your on-premise services, the relay service relays that request message via that rendezvous to your service, where you obviously process it and optionally return a response depending on the messaging pattern that you're using. Just a couple of notes about authentication. As I mentioned a bit earlier, Service Bus integrates with Access Control Service, which I'll introduce a little later, so that you can federate authentication of your services via the Access Control Service to those social identity providers that I mentioned earlier, LiveID, Google, Yahoo, and so on. When a service connects to the Service Bus, because it wants to start listening for requests from client applications, it has to authenticate itself, either using a shared secret token, which again you can copy and paste from the Windows Azure Management Portal and specify in the configuration file of your service, or there are other options for other type token formats. Clients can be required to authenticate. They don't have to authenticate if what you're publishing from your on-premise services to the Service Bus relay is a public endpoint. By default, no endpoints are public. You have to opt in public access, if you like. What you do get with the default configuration setting is clients have to authenticate when connecting to the Service Bus when they want to send a message to you. Okay, so that's kind of, I guess, a common design in WCF, if you like, where you have to opt out of security. It's the same with Service Bus communications. Okay, so a quick demo of this. So when you want to start using the Service Bus, the first thing you have to do is create yourself a service namespace. Again, in the interest of saving time, I've already done that. I've called it MVC Music Store. What that means is I have a public addressable URI now running in Windows Azure, in Southeast Asia, which is mentioned over the right there. It's a bit hard to see because it's a little bit out of focus. mvcmusicstore.servicebus.windows.net. That's where all my services that I connect from my on-premise environment will be hosted. There'll be a slash order service.svc or whatever that actual service endpoint might be. So that's the first step, to create yourself a service namespace. What I do with my on-premise service, if I just switch to some code for a moment, what I've created here is a WCF service application, an order service.svc with a little bit of logic in it, which basically accepts an order as a request and stores it in my local on-premise SQL Server database, the same database that I was syncing to the cloud in the last demonstration. In order to configure that order service, to enable it to connect to the Service Bus, there's two steps here. First of all, you have to install the Microsoft Service Bus SDK. You can do that by downloading it and installing it yourself, or there's a NuGet package called Microsoft.ServiceBus that will install it for you, which is what I've done with this WCF service application, which adds a number of references as well as quite a lot of configuration information. This configuration information here, which is part of the system.service model, so it's part of the WCF configuration, registers all the new bindings, relay bindings that are supported by or required to connect to the Service Bus, the ones I mentioned earlier. So an example of that is basic ACP relay binding, maybe NetTCP relay binding if I'm using that particular transport. Once that's done, the only thing is left for me to do is configure the secret, the shared secret that is required by the service to connect to the Service Bus, the on-premise service to connect to the Service Bus. That shared secret is something I can copy and paste from the Windows Azure Management Portal, and I copy and paste it into here. That's all I need to connect my on-premise service to the Service Bus and make it available to client applications. It's almost too simple. There is a little trick which if we have time a little later, I'll describe to you. I'm hosting this order service, WCF order service in IIS on my local computer. If I then browse to MVC Music Store
I've lost it. Let me go back here and grab this guy here.
I'm now browsing to my service bus namespace. Actually, I'll do it in IE because it's I get a more useful response. This is the Atom feed or the registry feed I told you about a little earlier. So this is where client applications can browse to discover your endpoints and how to connect to them. I don't have metadata exchange enabled on this service, but if I did, they'll be able to go, ?WSDL, download all the WSDL associated with these services that I've published to the service bus. So I've got my orderservice.svc running on my local IIS, published to the service bus, clients can now connect to it and send orders to my on-premise environment. On the client side, it's quite similar. So this is, if I just open up some code here, which is my MVC Music Store application, which I'm running in the cloud, which is the web front end. I add a service reference to, I haven't actually done it here, but I add a service reference to my on-premise service, downloads all the goodness and creates the proxy classes and everything associated with that. In its web configuration file, if I just scroll down far enough, there's a similar set of configuration settings. There's all the extensions are required to register the bindings and so on, relay bindings I may want to use, as well as because clients have to authenticate in this particular case when they want to connect to my service, they also use a shared secret, the same shared secret I used on the service side. So I guess the key message here is the service bus relay is ready to be used with just a few clicks in order to create yourself a namespace, effectively a public URI from which all your services can be accessed, with some configuration settings that will be registered for you as part of installing the service bus NuGet package on both the client and the service side, you're kind of ready to roll. So what I want to do is just quickly open the order service code. I've got a breakpoint in the code, so when a new order request is sent to my on-premise service, we should be able to see it break into that code. I'm going to go to my web front end, running Azure, buy a Nirvana album, add it to my cart, check my cart out. This is an ACS demo, which I'll introduce a little later. Sign myself in using my generic account, which I don't use for anything else but demos, so I don't send any email to it. There's my mobile phone number if you wanted that as well. I've changed IP addresses, obviously. I fill in the order form, Chris Padgett, 1 Smith Street, Melbourne. 3000 Australia. x@y.com. Running a free promotion on this site, so I'll get a free album. And what I wanted to demonstrate here is submitting that order form or that order information via the service bus relay to my on-premise service. So I'll do that now. And before I do that, I'll debug this WCF service application. And hopefully we should see it break into Visual Studio, which it has. There's the order that I filled in online. It's been relayed via the service bus to my local IIS service application where it creates the order. It's a synchronous operation, so this was order number one. And it's done. Pretty simple. Okay, moving on. Queues. So this is another technology or another feature that's supported as part of the service bus family, if you like. Queues, there are Windows Azure queues, which are kind of a bit lighter weight than this queuing feature that's provided by Service Bus. This is another queuing feature that you can use as part of your hybrid communication. On the left, we have producers, web apps, mobile apps, services, either running in the cloud or maybe running with your trading partners who send messages through a queue. Those messages are durable and will be stored and forwarded to your consuming application or service when that application service is running. So key note that these are durable queues, like all queues are, I guess. Producer and consumer don't have to be connected at the same time. It's a FIFO queue. produces send messages to queues using, at the very bottom there, the queue client class. It's also provided as part of the Service Bus SDK. One or more competing consumers receive messages from queues. So it may not just be one consuming application that may be receiving messages. You may have multiple consumers competing to receive messages from the Service Bus queues. Those messages will either be received exactly once or at least once, depending on the receive mode, if you like, that you encode into the consuming applications. Messages also have a time to live, so they'll expire after a given period of time, or if they've been received a given number of times and not processed successfully, not handled successfully, then they'll be moved to a special queue called the dead letter queue, where you can obviously manage those expired or poisoned messages. Queues are good for supporting load levelling. What this means is you may have a fixed number of producers sending messages at a fast rate. A web application is just kind of producing messages at a fast rate. And you may then have on the consuming side a variable number of consuming applications or services that receive those messages at a slower rate, because obviously part of that receive, they're also processing those messages. What load leveling means is basically you can level the load of that work by when the queue length is expanding, you may want to add more consuming applications or services to receive those messages, still processing them at a slower rate, but you know, trying to keep that load under control. Queues also support sessions for grouping messages, where you may want a conversation of messages, if you like, a thread of messages to be only received by a single consumer. So there's session support for message sending and receiving. And as I mentioned earlier, there's a common class as part of this Service Bus SDK called Client Service, where you do all the sending and receiving of messages. So to quickly show that, what I'm going to show again is submitting an order, but this time rather than submitting it via the Service Bus Relay, I'll submit it via Service Bus Queue. To do that, I think I just have to close this because I've got a bug in my code that doesn't allow me to order two things in the same session. The code is on Codeplex, not my code. Okay, so this time I'm going to buy a Men at Work album, add it to my cart, check the cart out. Because I've started a new session, I'll just have to sign in again. Didn't remember my last form, sorry about this. 1 Smith Street. The reason I'm being very particular about this is because, at least in the next demo, it's quite important I get some of this information right. So, quickly fill this in, free promo again. This time I'm going to submit it via Service Bus Queue. That's done. Now, the reason this has returned order number equals minus one, if you can see that up there, is because this is an asynchronous communication. The client has obviously submitted its message to a queue, but my consuming application, or service application, if you like, isn't running at this stage. That's this project here. If I then go and start this up, I've got a breakpoint in the code here. Once it starts up, it will begin receiving messages, which it's doing up there, and it's broken into the code because it has received a message. Next, I'll just talk through this code as I step through it. The message it received contains the body is the order that's been submitted via the web application. I get that order body out of the message, write to my database, save the changes, and it's done. That's it. So just switching to the code quickly before I move on with some slides. I'll just scroll up a little bit and walk you through what happened before and what happens after messages are received. There's some setup tasks that have to be done, but basically what this is doing is creating a connection string that's in my app config file. This is a console application that connects this code, this consuming application, to my Service Bus namespace in the cloud. Once it's connected to the Service Bus namespace, it checks if a queue called order exists. If it doesn't exist, it will create that queue for the first time. Once that queue has been referenced or created, then we use this static method on the queue client class. using the connection string and the name of the queue to create a client to that queue so I can start receiving messages, which is this line of code here. This can be a block receive or a synchronous receive if you like, or there's also async methods that you can use as well. Once a message is received and it's processed by getting the body and handling it or processing the order in this case, you either mark, if you like, the message as complete, which means it's removed from the queue and will never be seen or heard of again, or you can abandon that message, perhaps if an exception was raised, perhaps the database wasn't available, for example, so that the order could be saved to it. Once a message is abandoned, it's returned to the queue and the next competing consumer can then read that message and try it again. Just before I switch over, I'll just also show you the client code. Very similar to what we have on the service side, except I've got service bus queue order gateway. Does a very similar thing, has to connect, get some configuration settings in order to connect to the service bus namespace. Once it's done that, creates an instance of the queue client from that connection string and the name of a queue. Creates a brokered message that will contain the order that it wants to submit to the backend service and sends that message via the queue client. So a few lines of code and it's all done. The only thing I'll also show is the connection string that's required, which is up here somewhere. There's an application setting called Microsoft.ServiceBus.ConnectionString, which has sort of a multi-value value, if you like. The endpoint where my queue is being hosted, which is the name of the service bus namespace, and again, the issuer and the secret that's required to connect to that namespace. Quick question?
Can we actually check the status of your message as well from client side? So if it has been processed or not?
No, because it's asynchronous.
One way only.
That's right. You send it, and you trust that you will be held in the queue for as long as it takes for the consumer to read, receive and process that message. But you may use a queue that goes back the other way. So the consuming application may write another message to another queue that sends like an acknowledgement or a NAC or a NAC back to the client application to say your order has been processed, for example.
And the state is persisted at the service bus.
Sorry?
Yeah,
service bus manages the persistence of that message. The durability of that message is inherent in the service bus queue. It's part of the service bus queue. Okay, moving on. So a similar feature, which I may not have time to demonstrate now, is called service bus topics and subscriptions. So this is a similar diagram to what we had before. Producers send messages. Rather than to a queue, they send it to a topic. What service bus will do is publish messages from those topics to what are known as subscriptions. And you may have multiple consuming applications or services that are receiving messages from one or different subscriptions. What that means is, so a lot of these notes are similar to what we have on the previous slide. This topics and subscriptions supports like a broadcast messaging scenario where the producer wants to send information about maybe about a price increase. You may have consuming applications or services running in branch offices, for example, each subscribe to those messages. They receive, when they're available to receive messages, they'll receive those messages that've been broadcast from maybe the head office, if you like. A nice feature of subscriptions is you can also, as part of the subscription definition, you can specify filters. An example of this is maybe when I submit an order via my web role running in Windows Azure, and when I enter the order country or the shipping country to be Australia, I may have one consuming application that's running in my Australian head office, and let's say for argument's sake I have another consuming application that's running in the New Zealand head office or whatever it may be. Each of those consumers can specify different filters for different subscriptions. One may just want to know about Australian orders. The other one may only want to know about New Zealand orders. So they're filters that you can define as part of the subscription. You specify those filters using SQL 92 statements. So in this case, it might be country equals quotes Australia or country equals quotes New Zealand. That's how you define the filter. You can also optionally specify filter actions. So having received a message from a subscription that passes the filter, you can then modify not necessarily the body of the message, but the properties associated with that message. Unlike queues, where there's a common class used both on the sending side and the receiving side, for topics and subscriptions, senders use the topic client receivers use the subscription client. I might come back to a demo in a moment. The next feature, Windows Azure platform feature I want to introduce is Connect. So if you went to Michael's session yesterday morning about Windows Azure virtual machines and virtual networks, he introduced virtual networks, which provide a site-to-site VPN between the public cloud and your on-premises environment. Connect kind of predates virtual networks. What it provides is, what it enables you to do is connect Windows Azure roles, whether they be web worker or VM roles, the old-style VM roles, the stateless ones, with your on-premise servers, so computers, not necessarily applications or services. But what this allows you to do is create machine-to-machine connections, VPNs, if you like, between roles running in Windows Azure and things running on your on-premise servers. What this also allows you to do is join your Windows Azure roles to your on-premise domain so that you can manage them like any other computer that's running on your domain with the tools that you use today. Here's a simple representation of it. We have a web role and a worker role running in the cloud. On premises, we may have a web server, a file server, and a collaboration server. And what I'm showing here is the web role has a machine-to-machine VPN with a web server, so they can communicate with each other. And the worker role similarly has a machine-to-machine VPN with both the file server and the collaboration server, so they can see each other. Unlike virtual, a site-to-site VPN, because it's machine-to-machine, the worker role can't see the web server, the web role can't see the file or the collaboration servers. I mentioned the Windows Azure roles are supported by Connect. Common, I guess, scenarios for the on-premise services are our servers, our web, print, line of business, all those kind of legacy servers, if you like, that you don't necessarily want to, or you can't hoik into the cloud, where you may not want to use Windows Azure Virtual Network and you open up your whole site, this may be an option for you, where you have a legacy integration to do. Connections between the Windows Azure roles and your on-premise servers are established using relays, not service bus relays, but Connect relays that run in all the data centers around the world. And all connections are protected by IPsec, which gives it that machine-to-machine security. The thing that glues the Windows Azure roles and the on-premise services together are local endpoint groups. A local endpoint is just another name for an on-premise computer in the Connect language, if you like. Like SQL Data Sync, like Service Bus Relay, all the connections are outbound from your on-premise servers. In order to do that, you have to install what's known as local endpoint software on those on-premise servers. That local endpoint software, you download it from the Windows Azure Management Portal. You activate it using a secret or an activation token, which again is only available to you as an administrator in the Windows Azure Management Portal. And optionally, you can also secure those local endpoint software using an X509 certificate as an extra layer of security. As I mentioned earlier, you may want to join your Windows Azure roles to your domain. Where this is useful is primarily around authentication, where you want to access roles, perhaps from your on-premise environment, into Windows Azure roles using domain accounts. You want to run those roles using domain accounts to connect back on-premises to some of your services and applications. Or you want to secure those web roles running in the public cloud, using Windows integrated authentication. By joining it to the domain, you also get some domain name resolution capabilities. And the only condition around joining a role to the domain is you have to install that local endpoint software on your domain controller computer, which may scare a few infrastructure people, but it's a precondition. That DC computer must also be running the DNS role for this to work. Well, on top of all that, what that then means is you can manage your Windows Azure roles as if they were another computer in your network. So whether you use group policy or PowerShell or anything in between, you can use those management tools to manage your Windows Azure roles like you do your on-premise services. I'll quickly show you a demo of this. So if I switch the screens. So what I did as part of my deployment of my ASP.NET MVC application, my music store application, I configured it for Connect. I'll just quickly show you how to do that. So as part of the properties for the web application, the service definition, which is this project here. So as part of the role definition for my MVC music store application, there's a virtual network tab, which you can see that allows you to activate Windows U or Connect for this particular role using this activation token, which I'll obviously have to reset after this demo. What that does is when that MVC application is packaged and deployed to the cloud, it installs the local endpoint software, if I just pop that up, on this role. So that's now connected to Connect, one of the Connect, the local Connect relay, waiting to talk to something on premises. On premises, what I've done on my local computer is I've downloaded the local endpoint software, installed it, activated it using my special secret, and is now running on my computer. What I then have to do up in the cloud, or in the management portal rather, is under the virtual network tab, under Connect, is specify a local endpoint group. And this is what binds the Windows U role, or connects the Windows U role to my on-premise server, or my laptop computer in this case. I've created a group called MVC Music Store. If I just edit the properties of that, edit this group. What I'm basically telling it is when I create an endpoint group, I specify a name, and I say I want to connect from my computer, which is Padgett N55, with the role called MVC Music Store that's running in Windows Azure. Once that's done, I can do things like RDP into here and ping my machine. So I'll just stop this. I was just doing this to keep the connection alive, basically. So what I'm doing here is pinging my local computer from my Windows Azure role. It takes a few minutes just to kind of warm up, a few seconds rather. He said. And there you go. So that's now pinging my local computer via a Connect relay. What you will notice is the latency here, so the round trip ping time is about 450 milliseconds. I've created this Connect because my Windows Azure role is running in Southeast Asia. That's effectively the speed of light, if you like, or at least the ping time between Southeast Asia and my local computer. If this is important to you, this feature, then I'd suggest or recommend you host your web roles and worker roles that are connected via this in either West US or South Central US, because they have the fastest ping times. What I can also do on this computer now is open a browser, browse to an ASMX web service, which I'm hosting on my local computer again, and I get the help page. So for all intents and purposes, Windows Azure is now connected to my local machine and can do, you know, based on my firewall settings, of course, can reach a web service running on there. The reason I've chosen ASMX is because service doesn't support ASMX because it's not WCF. So as I mentioned in the notes in the slides, this Connect is a good way of connecting legacy applications, I guess ASMX is legacy these days, with Windows Azure roles that are running in the cloud. So when I debug this, start a new instance of it, go off to my MVC Music Store app, buy another album, sign in again. Still didn't get this. XXX. I think it's got to be a valid postcode, valid country. Fill that in, and now I choose ASMX as my order processing system. When I submit that, it's going via the Connect relay, via that machine-to-machine VPN, broken into my ASMX service with the full order attached, and I'll save that to my database. So just another option when maybe you're considering how you want to connect your Windows Azure roles with your on-premise environment. To close out the presentation, because I've only got 10 minutes left, access control service. So this kind of fills out the hybrid application story. It's not a necessity to connect your public cloud roles or your public cloud environment with your on-premise environment. There's kind of sort of a nice side effect of doing all this. Access control service was mentioned by Wade this morning, or this afternoon if you went to his session. It's a cloud service for authenticating users in what are known as relying party applications. That's just another name for your app or web app or web service. What it allows you to do is externalize authentication for your application with a range of identity providers that other people will manage identities on your behalf, basically. Those other people are Microsoft with Live ID, Google, Yahoo, and there are a number of others. What the Access Control Service also enables you to do is transform claims from those identity providers about the users that they're managing into claims that you want to make your application aware of. So an example of that might be when I log into Google like I just did, I sign in using an email address. It knows what my first name and last name is. Those claims about my email address and first name and last name may not be the same claims that are issued by Windows Live ID or Yahoo, for the example. So I don't have to reconfigure or recode my application just because I want to now onboard Facebook users or Yahoo users, where in the past I've been only enabling Google users to access my app. So transformation allows me to say, if you receive a first name claim from Google and a last name claim from Google, transform it into a given name and surname claim, for example. Because when I extend my application to enable Facebook users to authenticate themselves, where Facebook calls are perhaps F name and L name, I then also want to transform those claims into given name and surname. So there's a common claim set, if you like, that's issued to my application, despite the identity provider. Once those claims have been transformed and issued by the Access Control Service to my web application or web service, I can then perform authorization checks based on role or other claims about those users, be it their postcode, age, or whatever other information is tracked as part of those identity providers. It's compatible with .NET, Java, so all those common platforms. If you're using .NET as to build your web applications and web services, then you use or can use Windows Identity Foundation that has a tight integration with ACS. You manage your ACS account or tenancy, if you like, using the management portal, or if you like, if you want to automate some of this, there's a management service you can use as well. And ACS supports a range of sort of security protocols and token formats. This is the list of identity providers that are supported today. So if you're using the management portal, you can configure any of those identity providers, including ADFS if you want to federate with your on-premises AD. Or if you're using the management service, you can use those identity providers on the right. This is basically what it looks like at runtime. There's a lot that happens at runtime. If you're building .NET apps, which I'm sure you're all doing, and you're using Windows Identity Foundation, then it will manage most of this for you. So on the left, what it is representing is what's known as passive authentication, usually used with web applications where there's a number of redirects. User goes to your website, they're not authenticated, they're redirected to ACS. ACS asks them, do you want to sign in using your Windows Live ID or Google ID, which is what the screen we saw before in the demo. I choose Google, I go off to Google to sign in. Google issues a token about me, says, and signs it and says Chris is who he says he is. His first name is Chris, his last name is Padgett. That token is then returned to ACS because ACS trusts Google. The tokens it issues, it transforms any claims that I may have set up, issues a token back and signs a token and sends it back to my web application, and effectively I'm signed in. And my application knows that I'm Chris, first name Chris, last name Padgett. So there's a lot going on there. On the right is what's known as active authentication. So this is often used for smart clients, phone client applications, web services and so on, where there's no kind of redirection involved. And what happens in this scenario is, let's take the scenario of a web service, it has to authenticate itself with one of the identity providers shown in the left there, signs itself in, is issued a token. It then sends that token to ACS to say, I've logged in using a Google account. ACS says, OK, I trust Google, I'll transform any claims that Google have issued to you. And then the web service will send on the resulting ACS token to the claims aware service that my web service wants to integrate with. So it's a similar, it's not the same pattern, but effectively the end result's the same. Once all that has happened, in terms of authorization within my replying party application, my web application or web service, I can then implement role-based access control, whether I prefer it in code, attributes, or configuration. That capability is available to me. Those roles are expressed as claims, part of the ACS token that's issued to my application, and become available to me as part of the iPrinciple, kind of common interface that you're probably using today. What I can also do is implement what's known as claims-based access control. This is maybe where I want to use an age claim about a user, are you 18 years or older, to control access to my application or at least content within it. Don't know what I'm building to do that, but yeah. You've already seen the demo of this. I'll quickly just show you how it's set up. Did people go to Wade's session early this afternoon? No? Some of you did, some of you didn't. If I just switch back to the Windows Azure Management Portal and go to Service Bus, Access Control and Caching, which was where before, choose Access Control in the left menu there. Like I did for Service Bus, I have to create a new access control namespace, give it a unique name, indicate where I want it hosted, in this case, Southeast Asia. And once that's done, I then open the access control service portal. And there's basically only a few things you have to do in here to get all this connected. I choose the identity providers that I want to federate with. So you get Windows Live ID by default. You can add Google, Yahoo, any other AWS Federation providers that are shown here. I then go into Google, specify the text that I want to show as part of that page where I get to select who my identity provider is, that page that I step through each time I want to sign in when I check my card out, and an image perhaps that I want to show as well. I then register my relying party applications with ACS, so in this case it's my MVC Music Store application. I give a display name, a realm, which is used when I start the redirection process, a return URL, the token format that I want to use, so I won't go into detail on this, and a number of other settings. We can also specify rule groups, so I'll get a default rule group by default. What this allows me to do is do that claims transformation, so where Google may issue a first name, last name claim about me, perhaps want to transform that claim into a given name, surname claim, and that those transform claims are then issued to my relying party application. And that's basically all you have to do to get this up and running. So there's good online guidance about how to do this. Once all that's done, there's a little bit of configuration to do in your web application, on your relying party application. If you're using Visual Studio 2010, download a tool called Identity and Access. It's basically just a wizard that allows you to step through and configure your relying party application to make use of ACS. The key thing being that as part of your ACS, a AWS Federation metadata document is generated for you. And as part of that Identity and Access wizard that I just opened in Visual Studio, you paste that URL in and it kind of auto-configures your application for ACS and Federation. And that's it. What the user gets to see is obviously that page, or optionally that page that they step through to say, I want to sign in using Windows Live ID or Google. They sign themselves in and magic happens. If you're not using Visual Studio 2012 and you've installed Windows Identity Foundation, there's a tool that is added to your control administrative tools called FedUtil, which you can also run from the command line. It's a similar to Wizard, to the one I opened in Visual Studio 2012, that collects information about your application, the Federation metadata that's published by ACS, and the job's done. What it has done behind the scenes in my web app, and it's gone to sleep, is add a lot of hard-to-read configuration settings to my web config file. Just before I quickly summarise, because we are running about 5 minutes late, just would like to mention a few complementary Windows Azure services that kind of round out the hybrid application story. Caching is really important, obviously, where you're going a long way across the world to get to access some on-premises services or data. So the closer you can cache that data to your web roles or worker roles that may be running in Windows Azure, the better. So check out the caching service for that. Traffic Manager, you might cast your mind back 65 minutes ago to that complex-looking hybrid application architecture diagram with all sorts of boxes and arrows. It had the same application being hosted in multiple data centers around the world. That's useful, especially if your users, the users of your application, are sort of distributed around the world as well. The second Windows Azure service I mentioned here, Traffic Manager, allows you to globally load balance your users across those data centers. There are a number of kind of load balancing algorithms you can choose from. The most common one is nearest data center. So if you have users in Europe, they browse your application, they'll be load balanced, if you like, or directed to the European data center where you're hosting your application. Similarly, in Australia, for the most part, it kind of depends on the day of the week, but we either go to the Asia data center or the US data centers. So Traffic Manager is pretty much just a global load balancer across all your application running in multiple data centers. I mentioned virtual networks a little earlier, so if Connect doesn't do it for you, the other option for connecting the web roles running in Windows Azure with your on-premise servers is to create a site-to-site VPN using Windows Azure Virtual Networks. Not quite as simple as setting up Connect. So just in conclusion, we all know the benefits of the cloud. Despite what I've introduced today, there are many challenges with building hybrid applications. Windows Azure and the technologies, those fabric technologies I've introduced today, go a long way to helping us build those hybrid applications, to deploy them and also manage them when they are running. A couple of resources before I sign off. The diagrams that I've kind of copied and pasted from elsewhere are included in this PMP guidance document called Building Hybrid Applications in the Cloud on Windows Azure. It's the definitive guide on building these types of applications. I'd encourage you to go and search for that. It's about a 300-page PDF, so there's a lot of information in that, a lot of scenarios that they cover. If you want to get started, MSDN has some good overview information about building hybrid solutions, as well as some good detailed or good getting started guides on how to get started with each of these technologies. Just before I get to questions and answers, you can whisk off a mouse, you can get a helicopter ride, which I was fortunate enough to have one the other day, and it's worth the effort of coming up with a good tweet. After this session, or after the event, you can download these sessions, of course. And that's it. Open up to Q&A. Thank you very much. What do you have to do? So the question was, if I have a custom, or I'm using a membership provider to authenticate users, can I federate with it? What you have to do is, using Windows Identity Foundation, is create what's known as a custom STS, and that provides the kind of federation interface that you would then wrap around your membership service.
Then I can list that on the identity provider.
Yep, because it will publish itself as a WS Federation provider. The only caveat with that is they're very tricky to write because they're very tricky to secure. So you just do so at your own risk. Yeah. Thanks very much. So the question was, if a user signed in using their Windows Live ID or Google account, how do you tie that to the permissions or the roles that you may want to give them in your app?
Kind of domain, say I'm a bank.
Yep.
I've got a bank account, but for some reason I want to let people log in to the Google account with their Google credentials. How do I tie my account number? So every time they log in to Google, I know who they are. Do I have to pick their email address?
Yeah, usually it's their email address. So some... In general terms, it's like a username, their email address, so you'd treat it like any other username, an attached profile, whatever account information that's required to associate. Yep.
I think different providers
offer different things.
Facebook provides his Facebook ID
Yeah, so you may want to transform those different usernames, for want of a better word, into something that's common to your application. So you transform the email address Google claim into username, for example, that's obviously known by your application. Similarly, you do so for the other identity providers. Yep. If your users are Windows Live ID users, Windows Live ID doesn't offer many claims about a user. Not many meaningful claims. In fact, no meaningful claims. So it's just something to keep in mind. Yeah, really what it's doing, as I mentioned in the slides, is you're really just externalising that authentication logic to an external party who perhaps do it better than we do.
We need to store some sort of mapping.
Yep, but once you know who they are, then obviously there's other account and custom information you may want to keep about that user key to that username, that unique identifier. Cool. Well, BizTalk server could be part of the solution.
Part of the solution?
Yep.
So the message queuing, it seemed to me that it had a lot of the basics of messaging that are available in BizTalk server. I mean, if you've got a small solution, small site, but still simple B2B, this could be used in pretty much the same way.
Yep. So what I didn't mention, because I was already out of time, was there is a number of